Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I'm one of these strange people. It's like when someone asks me, can you teach the putting the garden to bed class? I'm like, well, because I usually don't typically put my garden to bed. I utilize it all the time.
Jamie Scholl has tips for growing and harvesting food even when there's snow on the ground. Gardener Farrell Johnson will also be with us to troubleshoot some drooping tomato plants from this summer. Farm equipment is big business these days. Harvest Public Media speculates if the market can keep its hot streak going. Excess strawberry plants need a new home, and a great recipe from Chef Daniel Orr for butternut squash and gnocchi. News kicks off every show. Luann Johnson has the latest.
The USDA's Food and Safety Inspection Service is reporting that a major salmonella outbreak has sickened an estimated 278 people across 18 states. Salmonella Heidelberg has been found in raw chicken from California's Foster Farms. Around three-fourths of people sickened in the outbreak live in California, although the USDA says it's unable to link the illnesses to a specific product and a specific production period. 42% of those sickened have been hospitalized, almost double the normal percentage of those usually hospitalized with salmonella. An article this week by Tom Philpott of Mother Jones painted a worrisome picture of the outbreak. He cited the CDC as saying the strain is, quote, resistant to several commonly prescribed antibiotics. With the government currently in shutdown mode, many are wondering how the FSIS is affected. While 45% of the FDA's nearly 15,000 employees have been forced into temporary layoffs, 87% of the FSIS personnel have been retained. The FSIS has tried to calm worries by stating that inspectors are still on the job, but communications workers have been furloughed, reducing the ability to spread the word of outbreaks. And according to a new study, many of the nation's top athletes have endorsement deals with companies that produce high-calorie, nutrient-poor foods. Given athletes' high visibility and hero status, researchers worry this state of affairs will be bad for kids. The study, which is published in the most recent edition of the journal Pediatrics, found that the athletes on Bloomberg's Power 100 list tallied over 500 endorsements among them, and roughly one quarter were related to food and drink products. 80% of the food products athletes endorsed were considered unhealthy, while a whopping 93% of the drinks were rich in added sugar. The American Beverage Association has denied any malicious intent on the part of food and beverage companies, arguing in a statement that advertisers did not have children aged 12 and under as their targeted group when brokering athletic endorsements. While the study didn't delve into how athletes' endorsements affected consumption habits, it did suggest that the influence athletes have on kids' eating habits warrants a closer look in the future. Find links to read more about these articles on the podcast post on our website. That's eartheats.org. And connect with us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search for Earth Eats.
Yep, we're posting all day, every day. Be sure to check us out. Luann Johnson, appreciate the work.
Thank you.
While the nation's economy was slumping over the last 5 years, the American farm economy was booming. Companies that make tractors and other farm implements have done exceptionally well, as many farmers replace their pricey equipment every year. But with commodity prices dropping and a major tax break in jeopardy, there is some question as to whether business will stall. Harvest Public Media's Bill Wheelhouse reports.
So in the end of the day, the big push right here is more efficiency. So you'll be now
at a farm trade show in Decatur, Illinois, in August. A representative of Gleaner Combine sells the finer points of the shiny equipment. On display, tractors and combines that dwarf the crowd. All across the Farm Progress Show, these mechanical marvels are the star attractions as farmers do their window shopping. But they don't come cheap. The price can reach upward of $500,000. Equipment is on the minds of farmers as this is harvest time. On this windy mid-September day, Len Corzine and his son are getting into the fields to start the harvest. A brand new green John Deere combine picks the corn and spits the chewed up stalks and cobs back onto the field. The Corzines farm 3,000 acres in Christian County in central Illinois. The 63-year-old Corzine says he has been buying new combines and tractors almost every year for a long time, and the reason is clear.
The most expensive time we have is if the combine has to stop or the corn planter has to stop. I mean, that is what it is all about in farming. You know, you've got to get it planted in a timely manner when conditions are right, and you've got to get it harvested.
The combine will only be used this fall on his farm. He's already ordered a new one for the next year. Corzine says the local dealer sells his used combines and tractors to the same area farmer, who then uses them for a year before trading off for Corzine's next machine. It's a cycle that farmers have been on in recent years. Over the last 6 years, new tractor sales have jumped more than 10%, combine sales 8%. Analysts say this is partly because of the farmers' large profits in the last few years, but tax incentives also are credited with helping to spur sales. Purchasers can get $500,000 deductions on equipment, way up from the $25,000 limit 10 years ago. There's also a bonus deduction for buying new equipment. But now corn prices have fallen, and the generous investment tax deductions that were increased as part of the stimulus may be returned to lower levels. Roger McCohen, director of Iowa State University's Center for Agricultural Law and Taxation, says at the end of this year, one of the deductions is set to decrease, another is set to expire.
So those are two things that really have been spurring, along with good times in agriculture, equipment sales. So without those, you take those out of the mix, I think it's pretty reasonable to say that we would probably see a slackening in demand for ag equipment, particularly new ag equipment.
A mile and a half down the road from Corzine's farm, it's the headquarters for Sloan Implement, one of the larger John Deere dealers in the nation with 17 locations in Illinois and Wisconsin. Company President Jim Steck says tax changes could mean some speed bumps ahead, yet
it would affect it a little bit, but I still think guys are going to trade equipment because if there's technology changing and not they don't want equipment that's worn out because of downtime, they're still going to trade equipment.
Technology is perhaps the most critical point to farmers like Corzine. The new combine can tell him about the quality of the corn, the size of the harvest, and can essentially drive itself using GPS coordinates.
You turn it on, it looks about like an airplane. But you've got actually two monitors that next year probably they're going to have those combined where there's just one. This one actually keeps track of more of the engine functions and functions of the machine. This is more the guidance and the yield mapping and those kind of things.
But technology alone doesn't sell tractors. And with falling grain prices, there may be pressure for Congress to continue those tax breaks a while longer. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. We're picking the brains of a couple experienced gardeners today to talk about what to do as the temps start to get colder and the ground begins to freeze.
Oh my goodness, the title. I'm still working on that one. But my name is Jamie Scholl.
We'll just go ahead and call her president of My Edible Eden, through which she offers gardening and permaculture advice and also sells a series of planting calendars for the various climate zones. So I posed the question to her, what should gardeners be doing now to put their gardens to bed for the year, prepping them to hibernate over the winter?
I'm one of these strange people. It's like when someone asks me, can you teach the putting the garden to bed class? I'm like, well, because I usually don't typically put my garden to bed. I utilize it all the time.
So like right now in her garden, she's planted bok choy, Jerusalem artichokes, sweet peas, kale, cabbages, and believe it or not, her tomatoes are still producing. She planted all these cold weather crops in August and September, and she hopes to be harvesting off them for the next few months. She scoffs at the notion that folks in the Midwest can't eat locally year-round.
Now, you won't be able to eat all of your food possibly as fresh, but it is possible, especially if you're going to preserve the harvest, whether it's drying, smoking, canning. There's a lot of different options. Freezing, it depends on how energy intensive you want to be.
Eating preserved foods is one thing, but is she really picking fresh food from her garden when there's snow on the ground?
You can. I have. I've harvested carrots before, the covering of straw. The straw will insulate. So a straw is hollow in the center, and that is like insulation. It provides a lot of, think of a straw bale house. That's an amazing amount of insulation there, more than a typical house. So if you cover your root veggies with this, you'll easily keep the ground from freezing and then be able to harvest. They'll actually be very sweet and much more tasty.
If you didn't plant fall and winter crops, you can still work in your garden this time of year to amend the soil for next spring. Farrell Johnson of Abundant Harvest Farm says this is key to getting good plant growth, especially in southern Indiana. Gardeners seem to have a love-hate relationship with the clay-based soil around here. On the one hand, it contains plenty of nutrients. On the other hand, it retains water and can easily become a swamp. Johnson doesn't mince words when he's talking about what it's like to grow food in this area.
It was literally some of the worst soil I've ever seen.
He was specifically referencing the soil by the district, Monroe County's Solid Waste Management and Recycling Facility. He installed a 9-foot circle garden with radishes and turnips just feet away from the recycling bins. He's anticipating this will be a successful public garden, so it's obviously not a lost cause, growing food in clay, but it does take some preparatory work in the fall.
The ideal thing to start right now is to till in 2 to 3 inches of quality compost into your garden, and that will help replace the nutrients that have been taken by the plants.
But he says gardeners should also think about planting cover crops.
To really amend, I would suggest a cover crop of either white Dutch clover, crimson clover, hairy vetch winter is also a good cover crop. Them are legumes, so that will add nitrogen back into the soil.
In addition to amending the soil, cover crops also protect the soil from erosion, which is just as important.
You don't want bare soil. Even if a person has to put straw all over their garden or something, I would always recommend some type of protection for the soil. It never should be left bare. It'll erode, and you'll really lose the nutrients that otherwise you could have kind of kept in that location.
I have a personal question. Okay. So I grew tomatoes this year, and they didn't ever really bear fruit. I had a lot of leafy greens coming off of these tomato plants. So I really want to have successful tomatoes next spring. Help!
And just from the what you kind of mentioned, it sounds like it could have had too much nitrogen in the soil. If it's too much nitrogen, you won't have the it won't go into the fruit cycle properly. And what I've noticed a lot of times is people want to go organic, but they'll either use too much nitrogen or just nitrogen without the phosphorus and potassium and the trace minerals.
So what can I do now to make sure that spring is going to be great?
Without me really looking at the soil, it should be at least dark and kind of have a dark matter look to it. So in this area, it's a complete total clay base. So in that clay base, you're not going to have success unless you actually amend the soil, and that's where the compost comes in. What you want to do is amend it, and then it actually becomes a living system that really starts compounding on itself. All the micronutrients and the microorganisms are really made available to the plants.
Gardening advice on the radio, perhaps easier to consume from our website. Get more tips from Jamie Scholl and Farrell Johnson at eartheats.org. One thing fall is good for is squash. Lots and lots of varieties of squash.
Okay, let me make sure I got everything.
Daniel Orr getting all the ingredients lined up in reverse order. He's got walnuts, gorgonzola cheese, sage, butternut squash, and gnocchi.
All right. One of my favorite dishes, and it's actually kind of pasta, is a gnocchi. And it is like a little potato pillow or dumpling. And I'm using a whole wheat gnocchi, so really healthy and delicious. I think they've got great flavor, a little bit of sourness to them. So I have those already cooked off. And basically what you want to do is cook the gnocchi until they float to the top of the salted water. You can just follow the package, and they'll become very, very soft and tender. Then what you do is you cool them down. And then there, you can set them aside and wait till your friends, family, guests come over. And then you just want to plunge them back into some hot water to reheat them and then dump them in the sauce. So today we're going to do kind of a classic Italian dish. The Italians love brown butter and sage. And we're going to add some local butternut squash. You could use any kind of winter squash. Anything from a pumpkin to acorn squash to turban squash, all those are considered winter squashes. Probably the most familiar people know is the butternut. And what I like to do is roast the butternut squash off with a little bit of spices, salt and pepper. And when you buy the local ones, you can actually just leave the skin on. And as long as they're washed really well, you don't need to worry about peeling them. What happens when you buy ones in a big supermarket, they usually are waxed. And what that does is it makes them keep even longer because they are kind of sealed in there. So if you're using one of those, you'd really want to probably scrub it really well or maybe even drop it into boiling water and then wash it. And that will get that waxy coating off. Okay, so then what we're going to do is we have a nice big pan over here. Because we want some surface area, so it's fairly wide. And we're going to add a little bit of olive oil and a nice nugget of butter. You can hear that popping there, starting to brown. Quickly, I'm going to add some chopped shallots to that. That's going to help cool the pan down a little bit. Okay, once I've got that in there, I'm going to throw my sage. It smells real strong when it's raw, but once you cook it, it really mellows out. So, you know, I put a good handful of sage in there, but it's not going to be too strong. Okay, we're going to add the butternut squash, and I put about a half a butternut squash, and this will feed about four people. Okay, we're going to stir that around just to heat it through. Okay, in the meantime, I'm going to plunge my gnocchi back into some hot water to heat it through. It's important not to overcook gnocchi because it'll become very, very tender and it will just kind of melt away. So it'll get too soft. So you just want to just heat it through. All right, so now shake off the extra water. I'm going to toss these in that nice sage butter. Okay, I'm going to add just about 2 tablespoons of water. I'm going to turn off the heat. Add about 1/4 cup of Parmesan. Now, you never add cheese to a pasta that's still on the heat. You always remove it from the heat, and then you stir it in. You can see that's kind of making a sauce mixed in with that water. Okay, and we're going to finish this with some toasted walnuts, a little bit of lemon juice. I got those over here, and a sprinkle of Gorgonzola cheese.
Woo! I can smell it from here.
Let me give this a taste. Oh, I don't think that's half bad. And then finish it, I've got some fried sage leaves. And that is our Tuscan whole wheat gnocchi with sage, gorgonzola, and walnuts.
And don't forget the butternut squash. This recipe is a real winner. The crew could not stop eating it. Make it for dinner tonight in your house. Follow the recipe at eartheats.org. Coming up, strawberry plants are looking for a good home.
If you just have like a hanging basket or something to put on a porch, these will do great there.
Stephen Hale of the Bloomington Community Orchard wants you to have some strawberry plants. Find out why coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage and hatha yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at TouchstoneWellness.com.
and Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
So these were planted standard 18 inches apart, neat rows, something like
18
that.
18 inches apart and in neat rows?
Yep.
It does not look like that now.
It's become a jungle.
The walkway surrounding the strawberry patch at the orchard is losing ground slowly but surely as the strawberry plants multiply. Stephen Hale volunteers at the Bloomington Community Orchard. He says the initial batch of plants was donated to the orchard in 2010, but they didn't keep track of how many or of what variety. One thing they do know is that these strawberries thrive in lousy soil and they love direct sun.
But now we're looking at this and we have too much of a good thing. We actually had a wedding here, a lovely couple, Charlotte and Brent, and they had a service project for their whole wedding party to help dig strawberries. So we had a dozen or more people digging for a long time, and you can see they hardly made a dent over there on the side.
Let's go look. Let's go. Yeah, how many plants can you estimate that they tore up here? Because this is really like a tenth of the circle of plants.
I would say easily a couple of hundred.
So the orchard is inviting community members to put on some old jeans and gardening gloves and dig up these strawberry plants for use in their own gardens. Could we dig one right now?
Okay, I'll be right back.
Okay, so Hale wades through the sea of greenery to find the roots of a plant and begins digging with his trowel.
Here is one of the root balls, one of the clusters you see here.
It's hard to tell the difference between one and another. There are just so many little tendrils.
Yeah. So we kind of get this one severed a little bit violently. The roots are also very dense, so it takes a little bit of prying. But here we go. Oh, we get a bonus earthworm as well.
Nice.
A couple of bonus earthworms.
Oh.
And you're welcome to take it home. You know that.
If you insist. So now when I take this home, it is, what is it, September. And if these aren't going to be fruiting until June, what do I do with this thing in the meantime?
Great question. If you just have like a hanging basket or something to put on a porch, these will do great there. And it'll go to sleep for the winter and come back in the spring.
No need to wait 8 months to enjoy your strawberry plants. Make like Leah Gauthier and turn them into art. I visited her in her studio as she was forming several sculptures out of bits and pieces of plants she just harvested from her garden, including parts she plucked from her Marshall strawberry plants. A green and orange leaf, a short red stem with a cluster of buds, a delicate white flower.
But I kind of am intrigued the most with this little Marshall baby. And just because the stem here is what used to be attached to the mother plant, and I just feel like I severed it. Sounds weird, but I feel like it should be bleeding a little bit right now. Maybe that's not the happiest thing.
She picks up her sewing needle and some red embroidery thread and stitches the thread into the stem, looping it back onto itself. She then photographs this miniature sculpture to be included in her project Mending Season. Since the materials start deteriorating as soon as they're harvested, the photographs are her only way to share the work.
I'm almost forgetting when I go out there that these are vegetables. So I have my artist hat on at that point, and I'm looking for texture, form, color. Now, the flowers super attract me because they're just crazy ephemeral. So they're going to last like for maybe a half hour, maybe less. And they're very, very fragile.
When did you pick these?
I just picked them like an hour ago.
Oh, so we got to get going.
And already you can see that they're starting to wilt.
So these items of art that you're creating, they don't last forever simply because the materials that you're using are perishable. This is sort of a different way of thinking about art, I think. As an artist, how did you come to that acceptance that your art isn't going to last forever?
I love that challenge of trying to let go. Things are always in motion. They are always changing. You can't take them with you wherever you... I mean, you know, they're here today, gone tomorrow. We're different people today than we are tomorrow. And I wanted to be able to give myself that challenge of resolving something and being able to move on to the next idea.
While she constructs sculptures with a variety of plants from her garden, she has a special affinity for her Marshall strawberry plants. Known for its exceptional taste and firmness, the Marshall strawberry was once described as the finest eating strawberry in America. But after World War II, the plant was devastated by a virus and almost completely removed from commercial production because of its delicacy. Meanwhile, Gautier was doing some research into American industrialized agriculture to find out why, according to her, a nectarine grown in the U.S. tastes muted as compared to one grown in Spain. When she found the Marshall strawberry on a list of endangered American plants, she not only wanted to taste the finest eating strawberry in the States, she wanted to bring it back to life.
But when I thought about trying to revive one little thing, that was something I could do, it felt like I had some hope.
In 2007, she requested a few runners from the only place that still grew the strawberries, the USDA's Germplasm Repository in Corvallis, Oregon. Gautier is now one of only a few private growers who are trying to revive the Marshall strawberry. She could be the only one of those growers who combines her love of gardening with her artistic life.
You know, I did certain things on one side and certain things on the other side, and then all of a sudden the realization came to me that food can be art. And so, bang, they just went right in together, and I've been in that space ever since.
Once she's done creating the sculpture and photographing it, she dismantles it right away, replanting whatever she can and nursing the plants back to life. But not so fast. As a new mom, these free moments are rare, so she's going to take advantage of it.
I think what I'll do, I mean, since my daughter's still sleeping, I might try to make three more sculptures.
See photos of Leah Gautier's work on our website. If you want strawberry recipes, well, hang tight until June and we'll give you some great ideas. In the meantime, visit our website to find out how to cook pumpkin and zucchini and greens, other fall favorites. That's at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Leah Gautier, Stephen Hale, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. It's been a good one today. Thanks for being here. I'm Annie Corrigan.